Thank you. My name is Paula Parton and I'm an alcoholic. Very happy to be here. Many of you I know, some of you I don't, but in a half hour we're going to know each other pretty darn well, I think. I started my timer because I always say it and yet it's true. I want you to like me when this is over. So, you never know where to start, right? I mean, 12 step is huge. You could have a whole weekend on just the 12 step and so this is, I think, where God and I are gonna start today. Before I jump into that, I want to say the most important thing about me is that I've been sober since October 29th, 1979. I took my first drink when I was 14 years old. Not that many years later, I took what I didn't know would be my last drink. And the kindness of you is what allowed me to sit all the way down and say that sacred maybe just a second before the first step and just a second between the first and second step. But the story of the experience that's coming to me right now on this is many, many years ago when I lived in a whole other city. I sponsored a young woman once she got out of her rehab. She came to my home group and asked me to sponsor her, and she was just precious, you know, and she just hated the ground she walked on, you know, hated herself. She had come in actually to that rehab on a suicide attempt that there was no reason it didn't work. But in rehab, she had an affair, like that's what we're gonna call it, but and she had been married and had two small children, and so I started sponsoring her, and you know, she hated herself, you know, the guilt, you know, tore her up about that. And some years went by and she and that husband divorced, and then my sponsee got into another relationship, and she found out that the new man she was in the relationship had been screwing around on her almost from the beginning. So she calls me and she because she just found out and told me, oh my God, he's been seeing another woman this whole time, lying to me this whole time. And I'm like furious because, you know, I'm not staying in my lane and I love her and I feel protective of her and all the not great things and still also great things. I'm like, that jerk, but I didn't say jerk. You don't deserve that. You're precious. You're wonderful. How could he do that to you? And she said to me, I did the same thing. And I said, no, you did not. That is not the same thing. And she goes, yes, it was. And I paused and I thought, yes, it was. And then what was the difference I was looking at between my loving her through the shame she'd had for screwing around on her husband and then oh protecting her and being furious with the man she had done that who had done that to her? The difference is this. The only difference is love. That's the only difference. So from that day, a long time ago, most of the time I fail, but most of the time when I'm looking at a situation that's not pretty to me, a person that's not, you know, great to me, whatever that means, I ask myself this question, what if I loved them? Then what would I do? Then what would I think? Then how would I feel? And the thing is this, my God, which I get to define just like you get to define yours, my God doesn't play favorites. My God doesn't give me tests or you teach me lessons. If that's your God, great man, grab onto that. Just not mine, that's all. But what if I'm wrong? I don't know, right? I don't know. What if God does play favorites? And the person I want to go at is God's favorite. Uh-oh. And that's another question I ask myself. I mean, I know it's not true, but what, you know, what if I'm going? I mean, and the thing is, man, we do know this, that God's love is universal. The same grace, the same light falls on us all. And I remember, you know, I grew up under the lash of my mother's alcoholism. I don't have any emotions about it. I mean, these steps and the outside help that the steps led me to. I mean, I'm clean and clear, and it's just now tools to help others and tools to look in, more inward and see new things to lift to the light. And but God is God, in God's economy, nothing is wasted. And actually, my favorite part of the big book, I think, is the greatest 12 step sentence there is, and it's not in the 12 step. It's on page 124 and it starts with this word, cling. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. So I want to say this to that, you know, I got to you at 14. I was court mandated to come to you. I mean, I drank like all you guys drank. The day before I took my first drink, I would have sworn I would never drink. And if there had been a lie detector test, I'd have passed that test. But I went out the next day. Friends handed me 3 bottles of wine and down they went and down I went right with them. My mom had just joined AA, man. So, I was in trouble and court mandated to go to AA meetings. And I want to say this, man. Those moments before a meeting, those moments after a meeting are as important as the hour of the meeting in service to others. Because I remember going down to them, my first meeting, it's like I'm standing there right now, tiny little Grand Island, Nebraska, walking down that tiny little clubhouse steps to the basement. And those people love my mom. And I know they knew what I was doing to her. So I went down there and I'm all braced up for the conflict. You know, I knew they were coming at me. And I looked across the room and I saw like the grand poobah of AA in Grand Island, Nebraska. I mean, nobody really, that's not much for the mojo, but whatever. And I knew that guy was coming for me and I'm bracing up, you know, because you're so bad when you're 14. And I will never forget this. From across that room, he was talking to somebody. He turned his head and he looked at me. And he smiled. And he stood up and he put his hand out and he crossed that entire room to come welcome me. Like I was a person or something. And those 15 seconds of superhuman kindness is the reason I'm your speaker today. And I finally got sober when I was 17 years old. But I had brain damage, actual brain damage. I was savage, more feral than human. And I mean, I was causing all kinds of damage in AA meetings. I mean, I was wearing clothes that didn't belong on a stripper pole. And like, I'd come late because more people look at you that way. And like, I'd gossip about everybody and I wouldn't get a sponsor because no one's as smart as me. What a dilemma. And like, I couldn't read the big books for you old, boring, drunk people. And I mean, you can imagine. But you think us weirdos in the back of the room aren't paying attention. The opposite is true. So here's the gig on those minutes, those actual 23 hours after the AA meeting. We are hyper-focused on you, actually. We are hyper-focused on how you act the minute that meeting's over, how you behave in your life outside of the sacred hour of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we, us weirdos in the back of the room, are looking for a way that this is another place that I don't fit. It's another place that's dangerous. It's just another lockup. It's not going to work for me neither and this either. Now, I'm telling you, man, the thought of killing myself was rutted in my brain. It was a neuro pathway. And if you wouldn't have been kind to me, I was happy to go out. I was aching to go out. But something about you caught my eye. I knew I'd never seen it before, and I was curious about it. And now I know the name of what I saw way back then was hope. I'd never seen it before. I never felt it before. And just by being you, by being safe place, man, no nasty man made me feel some nasty way, said some nasty thing, tried to make me do some nasty thing, happened in every institution I'd ever been. And I just thought this was another place. But you were honorable. And only because you were honorable, I could, even through the brain damage, hear small words that you said. I could hear you because of your beautiful 12-step work. You don't even know you were doing. You were just being sober. But I could hear you. Hear your quote from the big bit where it says, deep inside, every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And I think, oh, not for me. God had done me wrong. I'd begged God to save me when I was a little girl, and to my little girl mind, God had abandoned me. But honorable you had said it was true. And so I could not believe it for me yet, but I could at least believe that you believed. And that was enough, man. That was the first crack in the armor. And that was enough to get just the tip of my big toe onto the broad highway of Alcoholics Anonymous and the spiritual experience that we talk about in this step also, as if it's a gift at the end of 1 through 11. And I am here to tell you it is the gift from 1 through 11. The 12 step is the gift, but it's not the destination. The highway is broad. I've been sober 44 years, man. I got to continue to look, continue to seek, continue to listen, continue for another change, a more light, because light, as my friend Marty says, is the best disinfectant. And so how I live too is 12-step work in the meetings, out of the meetings. And God has turned my dark past into beautiful things, beautiful, unique gifts that I only have because I walked through a dark past. That's all. Like, I used to help little kids at the elementary schools for 12 years. It was my career to find mentors for the kiddos who've been thrown away because I was a throwaway kid. Because I stunk as a little girl. I stunk like cat urine and I was hungry and dirty. And so I can spot those kids, man. I have a superpower because to the last day of my employment, I'd look for another little kiddo from my program. I'd walk down the hallways of the elementary school and inhale. Who else but that magic math of the universe? How does that even happen? I know steps 1 through 11, and then we're here at the gift. But I'm telling you, man, not that far under my sobriety, I'll say maybe 2, 3, 4, 5-ish years sober, when I'd hear happy, joyous, and free, I thought, oh, there it is. That's the payoff. That's the goal. So every day I'd wake up, oh, am I happy, joyous, and free? No. And then the rest of the day spent concentrating on why not? But then I realized that is a gift. Service is the gift. Service changes perspective. And when I said I was a little girl and begged God to save me, I did. I remember a night in particular, man, I was going to give it my all. I was 8 years old because my mom was letting all kind of people into the house and they were, doing all kind of things. And I was begging God to save me. And I woke up the next day and to my little girl mind, God hadn't saved me. But here's what I know, because I know my God, that my God did not abandon me. That my God said to me that night and every night, hold on, daughter. I am sending Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will be relieved of care, boredom, and worry. There you will be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. And the promises have come true. Almost every step in our big book has promises attached to them. We always read the ninth step ones, but I was in a conference a few years ago and they were reading the ninth step promises like they always do. And you know how they say that part are these extravagant promises in the letter, and then the next line is, we think not. Usually people chant it out because they're enthusiastic. Great, keep it up. They think, are these extravagant promises? We think not. But I thought, oh, yes, they are. Oh, yes, they are extravagant and still true. That's the magic math. And I think, I mean, everything I say, I could have a whole change tonight and come on and say, I want to edit. But for now, on the ground I stand on right now, is I think this, man, that the most important question I won't say you, that I have ever asked myself and can ever ask myself in my sobriety is this question: Is God everything or is God nothing? That's the question. Because however you or I answer that question dictates the next steps I can possibly take in my life, dictates the next obsession or not obsession. My answer for me in this day is that God is everything. So if God is everything, here's what that means. Somebody does something hurtful, but it doesn't hurt my feelings. I'm coming to the conclusion, I think, that it's impossible for someone to hurt my feelings, actually. Because if they do, it means their opinion is higher to me than the God of my understanding. And that's just not true. A long time ago, I was about 9 or so years sober, and I used to raise money for this huge United Way agency. But My professional mentor and I, who's this cool lady, had just finished this huge event. And so we were at her house just, you know, cleaning up and like, you know, relaxing. And she said the most interesting thing. She said, you know, we come into this world alone and we're going to go out of this world alone. I'm like, well, that's a little morbid. But I never forgot she said that. That was like in 1989 or something. I never forgot. I'm like, why do every once in a while I take those words down? Here's why. Because it's true. Except for one important addition. We do come into this world alone, except for God. We are going to go out of this world alone, except for God. There is only one relationship that matters. That is the relationship of me to the God of my understanding. After that, it's cool, man. Be who you are. Say what you want. Do what you want. Me and God are a little busy over here. You know what I mean? And I used to love conflict. It was exhausting. I didn't know way long sober that like if somebody said something, you know, mean about your home group or mean about me, I didn't know it didn't immediately mean fight. I didn't know. Or like hurt feelings or talk about it ad nauseum. Oh, I didn't know. But now, you know, when I see some kind of conflict like that, most of the time, I don't even notice it. The other times that I do notice it, I'm like, oh, I remember when that used to be interesting. And I mean, pain was the touchstone of that progress. I didn't reach the conclusion that God was everything until I was 30 years sober. When I was about 18 years sober, living here in Champaign, I met and married my husband, St. Richard, and we wanted a baby, though I was an older parent, and he was going to be, he's 10 years older than me, but we wanted a baby, you know, and so I got pregnant, and then in June of that year, I lost my mother and the baby. And it wasn't too much, but it felt like just too much. And I was hemorrhaging at home, and the nurse in the ER was talking to me on the phone, and she was saying, you got to come in for a transfusion. It's been going on too long. And I am sorry to say that there was a couple minutes I knew it wasn't a bad way to go out. But I was a member of a home group and they were not having any of that. And they came in without my permission to my house, dropped off food for my kids, picked up my kids to take them to band practice. Some of them got up to my bedroom, sat on my bed without my permission, took my hand and talked me into getting up, going to get the transfusion. And I did, and I lived. And here's how they did it. They said to me, Paula, someday someone will need this exact experience from you to help them. And I have sober feet. And 2 weeks later, I was at my home group and a young man raised his hand when it was time to ask if anyone's visiting from out of town. He says, yeah, I'm in town because my mom died. And I don't know if I can stay sober without my mom. I said, I got you. I'm in a sponsorship line that's over full. Yeah, well, lots of late, over 100. And I'm, you know, our sponsor somehow has the magic ability that we each feel we're particularly, like, specially loved. And she's just come out of a hard time of life where she was caring for her husband and lasted a long time. And it was harder than anyone could have imagined, and then would get harder. And I have a pretty open schedule. So, I mean, I would just fly out, you know, and help. And a lot of us did. It's not a big thing. Just a lot of us did. But one time, one of my sponsors said, do you think you're her favorite? And I swear to God, I'm like, I swear to God, what my whole feeling and thinking and everything was, I don't care. It hasn't crossed my mind. You know, it's just the only thing I could say was, how can I help? That's the only thing we can say. How can I help, man? And our primary purpose, man, is how I really make all decisions to stay sober and to help, excuse me, other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So I'm deciding on an action, I ask myself, does this fulfill my primary purpose? And then, I mean, it does not say in a special edition of the Big Book just for me that it to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety, comma, unless they hurt your feelings, Paula. It doesn't say that. Or comma, unless they were mean to you, Paula. No, it doesn't say that either. My sacred duty in the 12th step is to keep the bridge built. That's it. If someone needs help and I'm the only one when they barely can lift their head and I'm the only one in their line of sight, I had better not have done anything to damage the bridge to recovery. I had better not have shunned them at a meeting. I had better not have not greeted them. I had better not have, they better not have heard me gossip. They better not have heard me run down in somebody else's home group. Like, what do I think? I know what people's home group should be or what people's seventh step should be. People's seventh steps, sacred seventh steps, are not my business in my timing or in the definition. That's a sacred time between only their God and only them. And if I'm running them down or making a judgment on them, then I think I'm in charge. I'm in charge of their seventh step. And then there's no end to the chaos if I'm in charge of people's seventh steps. Plus, it's exhausting. I'm 61 and tired, man. I'm not in for it anymore. My two oldest boys drink like we drink, and it's not going well. They've been at the jumping off place for longer than I've seen anyone stand at that dangerous and precarious place. And my sacred duty, now that everything is on the line, is to keep the bridge built to them. I was in Rome last year, and Rome's a city with a very, very, very high homeless persons population. And I'll tell you, I mean, some days in the living with my son's alcoholism, I feel almost at peace, a facsimile to peace anyway, that I do know they have a God. I do know they are God's favorites. You know what I mean? As are we all. I do know that even if the worst happens, that it is walkable because I have seen others walk it. That if the worst happens, at least they will be at peace. Some days I am in that space. Other days I beg God to save the lives of my son. So this day in Rome was a begging God day. And it's a good day to be in that space because there's a church every block and a saint in every church. So I was, you know, walking and went into, lit candles, prayed at yet another church, begging God to save my sons. And I'm so embarrassed to tell you, I am so embarrassed. I can hardly pick my head up to look at you. But I left the church, and right outside of the church was a young man, a young homeless man, and I walked past him. And I took exactly two steps before I stopped, realized what I had done, and realized this, that I cannot beg God to save the lives of my sons and walk right past another mother's son. That somewhere in the world there was another mother begging God for aid to come to her boy, and I'm the one standing there. So I got down to his level, because that's what we do, and gave him words of kindness and humanity and money. Wouldn't I want that for my children? Wouldn't I want that for any of you? And if it's true that pain is the touchstone of spiritual progress, that the price of admission is pain, I've wondered in God's magic math, because, I mean, we don't know. But what if my pain is the price of someone else's admission? Would I pay? Yes. Yes. I would pay. Another aspect, weird, but in my mom's drinking is I was the youngest, so I was at the end of her drinking, and this always sounds pitiful, and I don't mean it to. I'd be at little, you know, my little chorus things or playing volleyball, and nobody would be there to watch me. And I remember purposefully, I wouldn't even look for her anymore, because it was worse if people noticed that I noticed. I know it's a weird, not particularly unique, but probably particularly unique to kiddos who grew up in alcoholism. I'm just saying I have this experience. So in my town that I live in, there's a huge group home complex, and it's for kiddos who whose parents have not been doing the right thing. They get taken out of their parents' homes. And one time, a sponsee I have here started sponsoring a 16-year-old who's in that group home. And my sponsee said to me one day that my grand sponsee was going to be in a band performance at the high school that day. I said to my sponsee, "We're going." She said, "We are." I said, "Yes, get in the car." Because we were almost going to be late. And so we're rushing to get there. And we get to the high school, and the people watching are on the risers. It's in the huge gym. And then the band is on the way down on the floor of the gym. And we open the doors, and I came in the wrong doors. And I can see the back of my little grand sponsee way down there. But unless something happens, she's not going to even know there are people there who care about her, who want to mark this moment with her, who are proud of her. Look at that math. What? Who would know, man? Who would know but me what that would mean? And so there's like 50 huge people in the way between my sponsee and me, and get into the other end, that if we can get there and she looks up at us at just the right angle, she'll see us. And so, I mean, 50 huge people. And my sponsee says, "Can we make it?" I said, "Hold my latte." And I'm like rushing in there, and I'm pushing him aside, and I'm saying I'm sorry, but I am not sorry. And I get there, and we get to the end, and the conductor has already picked up his baton, and I rudely, and I don't care, yelled out my grand sponsee's name, and she looked up and saw us, and her face, I would pay any price, again and over, to be able to know that kind of service, to provide that for her. And God is a magic mathematician. And I have a really serious math learning disability, and yet I can recognize the weird physics of how it all works, the connections of all of us. And many times in my talk, I don't really say this anymore, but is that I know, I mean, I only have a half hour with you. When I'm at a conference, I only have like 50 minutes with them. And so to spend any time like talking about my son's stories, I know it's not my story to tell, but why I do is this, man, because of this beautiful 12 step, man, because I know God works in circles and connections, insane ironies. I know this, that one of you may very well be the person sent at the back of the room to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you may be the ones to say, "Welcome to my babies." I'm going to end there. Thanks so much.